There are two issues before the court on this case, and I would, unless you have questions, I'm going to address both of them. The first is, was the district court required to have subject matter jurisdiction over the plaintiff's claims to be able to prove to approve the conditional settlement agreement? And the second question is, did the plaintiff have standing and an injury in fact is required by Spokio? So on the first issue of whether or not the district court was required to have subject matter jurisdiction over the plaintiff's claim in order to be able to prove that conditional settlement agreement, we assert that respectfully it was. Now, the district court said that it did not need to decide whether or not the plaintiff had standing to bring her claim. The court said, because instead what I have is a conditional settlement agreement that the parties approved, that the parties agreed to, and therefore that confers subject matter jurisdiction for me. And so respectfully, the district court concluded that the parties conferred subject matter jurisdiction on the district court, which we assert is an error. The district court cited the Fifth Circuit's decision in Earhart, but we assert that Earhart doesn't stand for that proposition. The black letter law is that the parties can't confer subject matter jurisdiction on the court. Can't say we just decided to agree, and therefore we would ask the court to overlook the standing requirement. Earhart was a situation where the plaintiff had standing at the time the parties entered a conditional settlement agreement. And only then was there a legal change. So the Fifth Circuit in Earhart said, we have jurisdiction because at the time the settlement agreement was entered, there was subject matter jurisdiction. Here, the opposite is true. There was never standing under this case as clarified and required by the Spokio decision. This case, we cited Groshek because it seems to be the Seventh Circuit decisions are popular today. We cited the Groshek decision because it is the same law, the same facts. Groshek was actually further along in the process when Spokio was issued, and the Seventh Circuit affirmed the lower court's dismissal of a class action, Fair Credit Reporting Act class action conditional settlement, because the court concluded that under Spokio there was no injury in fact.
Would there have been standing at the time this case was filed?
No, there was not. Now you might say, well, then why did you remove it? It's still a federal claim. And so we have the defendant has a right to remove it under the federal question. And then Spokio clarified, but did not change the law on standing, just clarified and said these are always the standing requirement. So it's our position that there was never an injury, in fact, sufficient to say.
What if the settlement had been approved and then Spokio was decided? Could you come back and undo it then?
Yes, that's exactly what happened in Groshek. Because there's a conditional approval and then there's an entire process under the class action rules which requires the court's continuing actions requires additional actions by the district court. And once it was determined there was no standing, then the court is not authorized to enter.
What if a final judgment had been entered?
And the money's paid? The Arbaugh case suggests that subject matter jurisdiction needs to be maintained throughout the life of the case. But if the monies had been paid and there's no vehicle, and I don't think that would have been an issue.
You'll concede that's too late.
Because that would require right now every case that had been decided pre-Spokio, no matter how far back it went,
right,
to be somehow overturned. The money's been paid. I don't know how that would possibly.
Counsel, did Spokio really change the law, or was it just a reminder?
It did not change the law. Spokio itself made that clear. Spokio said repeatedly in the decision that we are just clarifying the standards that have been in existence from day one, that Congress can create can have a statute which says there are violations, but we as courts are constrained unless the plaintiff also has standing by way of an injury in fact. And so And that's been an issue that's been argued by the parties. And we respectfully think that there's been a concession that the law hasn't changed. And the law hasn't changed. It's just been clarified.
The district court never made a ruling on whether the plaintiff had standing on either one of the theories of her claim, right?
That's correct. The court said she did not need to, the district court said it didn't need to make that determination because the court said, I have a settlement agreement, so it's a contract that confers jurisdiction on me. And so did not address, and it had been attacked both facially and factually in front of the court. The court just said, I don't need to address it at all.
So you're asking us to do that for the first time. We'd be the first to make that determination.
Yes, and I believe, because there is no injury. I mean, this case lines up, that's the second part, but it lines up directly with your decision in the Breitenberg case. There's no injury to be found.
Well, what about the adverse action subclass? The idea that if you don't get notice regarding the report that they've run on you, and you don't have an opportunity to even respond to what it is that they're basing their non-hiring decision on. Isn't that an injury?
No, and I would say that was addressed by Spokio for this. And in this particular case, the plaintiff, the information is true.
Well, true or not, I think there's context, there's explanation, there's an ability to sort of go back and forth. And even if it is true, is that standing or is that just whether there's any sort of damage or a claim?
Well,
aren't you getting to the merits to determine standing?
And I know that you're not supposed to get to the merits to determine standing, but Spokio said, okay, just because there's this technical breach of the FCRA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the plaintiff's burden is to show, okay, where's your injury? And in the particular case, the disclosure, okay, someone's ordered a criminal background check report on me. The FCRA would say, you have to tell them that it's been ordered, you have to give them a copy, and you have to give them 7 days. So in this case here, saying even if the summary of rights under the Credit Reporting Act had been given to the plaintiff, there's no injury that follows that relates to that conduct because Spokio, of course, requires an injury in fact, and it also requires that the challenged conduct has to be the cause of the alleged injury. And so here, the one named plaintiff has a criminal record, revealed it, said that, and she actually provided false information to the employer here and said, I've not been convicted. And so the report comes back, shows she has a conviction. The employer, according to the plaintiff, then technically violated the FCRA by not waiting the sufficient amount of time to give her the opportunity to object.
But I guess it seems to me that that's sort of bleeding into the merits a little bit. Is it, maybe in this particular case, I think the plaintiff might have had an explanation for, well, you don't understand. That wasn't it. She was released earlier. There may be other things that she wanted to tell the employer, and may not be meritorious. But I guess I'm struggling with the line between merits and standing on that argument. And
so, if we look just at what is the alleged injury? What is the alleged injury on that particular point? Is it a non-consensual? It has to be a informational injury. I think that's what the plaintiff calls it. It's an informational injury. You didn't give me what I was yet. But Spokio still says, even if you didn't receive exactly the information in the format that's required by the law, you still have to show that you were injured by that. And so
she didn't get the job.
But that's not an injury that's fairly traceable back to the defendant's challenged conduct. Because the information is true, and she wouldn't have started where there's no even minor pay gap. Because factually, the facts that were submitted to the district court were that the company's set policy was to conduct the background check. No employee starts working until the information comes back. So she didn't get the job, but she would have never gotten the job even if every I had been dotted and every T had been crossed. I actually would like to reserve the remaining part of my argument for rebuttal. So.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Brooks. Morning, Mr. Watkins.
Jason Watkins on behalf of the plaintiff. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This matter was originally filed in the state court of Missouri. The defendant removed it to the federal court. The parties then settled the matter. The defendant then filed what Judge Lowry considered a 12B1 facial attack on the complaint. Therefore, the plaintiff's averments in the complaint must be true and all reasonable inferences must be given to the plaintiff. Your Honor, let me make clear the issue before the court today is not one of accuracy of the consumer report. That's what Spokio and the Supreme Court considered. That's not what's before the court today. What's before the court, the issues are, one, that she did not get the information required, and two, that her privacy was invaded. And I'd like to start off with the first issue, which is the disclosure form. And it's not a format issue, as the defendant called. The issue is she wasn't given a proper disclosure, and she didn't authorize certain actions the defendant took. The defendant will probably get up here and point to the very first sentence of this disclosure, which is what was provided to the plaintiff. And the very first sentence reads that the defendant will conduct a criminal background search. Now, I would imagine we're going to go about halfway down the form, and they're going to say that's where the authorization resides. And I'll read, the authorization says, I authorize the company and its representatives to make an independent investigation of my criminal records. So that's what they're probably going to claim as the authorization when they get back up here. Both of these clauses fail to satisfy what the Congress created within the FCRA. Judge Lowry, who decided this case, has held in the past, there is a major difference in authorizing the procurement of a consumer report and authorizing the procurement of a criminal background check. Major difference. A consumer report is a snapshot into our personal life. It's not only going to show you your criminal history. It's going to show you your credit history, your address history, your education history. Did you file a bankruptcy? Do you use aliases? You get to look at all that. That is not the permission that was asked for by the defendant. The defendant asked to look only to the criminal background, but that's not the actions they took. If we'll take a look once again at the consumer report, which under the joint appendix is page 106, you'll see that the consumer report consisted of four different components. Okay, and I'm going to talk about each of them, and I'm not going to put them in a particular order, so I apologize for that.
What's the injury, though, that flowed from that?
Well, and that's what I was going to get to, Your Honor. So if we look at the fourth component of the consumer report, that's a national sex offender database. That's not a criminal search. That is a civil database, and it provides information on people who are on the sex offender registry. Rhea Schumacher was never notified. It was never disclosed to her that database would be searched. She did not authorize the defendant to access that portion.
But again, what's the injury that flowed from that?
The second part is, if you'll look at the very fourth one, or at the fourth one, the locator. Okay, the locator is a social security trace / address history trace. This is a portion the defendant accessed that. It never asked her for permission to access it. It never... Okay. Got authorization. And you're going to ask me, what's the injury?
Exactly.
So, I'm going to tell you this.
Not just what the injury, what was pled as an injury that flowed from accessing that information?
It was pled that, one, that was never disclosed to her, that they would get that information.
Again.
And two, it was pled that she was never authorized. So she never gave them permission to get that. For example, let's step back here, and I think it'll address what you're asking
me. Okay, because you're telling me the action, but you're not telling me the injury.
Right. At common law, if a person set a foot on somebody else's property, we would have injury because we see that as a trespass. Here we have intangible data floating around there, and they've set foot on it. I'll take it a little step further. Let's say the defendant asked to come to my farm and go mushroom hunting. I say, yeah, go. That's fine. Go find some mushrooms. And then right now we're in deer season, and I go out and I get in my deer stand, and lo and behold, there they are with a doe down. Well, there's a bunch of does on my property. I'm not worried about it. They didn't have permission to take that.
But I think what you need to tell me is they didn't have permission to look at her financial background. They found a bankruptcy. They didn't hire me because of the bankruptcy. Now we've got an injury that flows from that information.
Okay. And what we have pled is that they looked into her address history. They ran her social security number trace. They didn't have permission to run those traces. They didn't have permission to dig into her background. Okay. And as this court held
it. But was it further pled that based on something they found in an unauthorized area, some harm came to your client?
Your Honor, that was not pled.
Isn't that what Spokio requires?
No, I don't believe is what Spokio requires.
And how about our case?
Okay. And I would point to this court's decision in the Eighth Circuit of Hagelin v. Aiklin County. There you have an unauthorized access into somebody's personal information. And this court found that where an individual's control of information concerning her person is a privacy interest. And that's what we're saying here. She should have control of her personal interest. That gets right to your injury you're speaking about, Your Honor.
Counsel, we understand that, but why is that not just a technical violation?
Because she never permitted them to search that part of her personal history. Much as in Hagelin, the law enforcement was never permitted to check into her driving record, to get into her records. Here, they were not permitted to get into her address history. They never sought, they never disclosed to her they would do that. They never were authorized to do that. So just as in Hagelin, they were never authorized to get her personal information. Here, they were never authorized to get her personal information. They never disclosed to her, never said, hey, we're going to get this information from you. Which kind of brings me to the second claim we have here, which Your Honor kind of spoke about, and that's the adverse action. In the state court, we pled four different things. We pled one, that the defendant withdrew the offer of employment over the phone. Two, that the adverse action was based on information contained in the consumer report. Three, that it would be more than 2 weeks after the adverse action before she would actually receive a copy of the consumer report. And four, she was never given any opportunity to contest or explain the information contained
in the consumer.
Counsel,
in that regard, had she been given notice and an opportunity to respond, what explanation did Ms. Schumacher want to present that would be material to her disqualification for the job?
Your Honor, to a certain extent, you're asking me to kind of speculate and predict the future. I don't know the actions they would have taken, but I could tell you, Ms. Schumacher, you know, they would have been looking at a form, and the form doesn't look good. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It says that she was convicted of armed robbery, she was convicted of murder, she was sentenced to 35 years in prison. That's what they're looking at. What she would have told them, though, is, listen, I was a 17-year-old girl. I was going to a friend of mine to buy drugs with my mom's boyfriend and her brother. My mom's boyfriend and her brother shot and killed that man. They robbed him. I had 35 years in prison. My sentence was reduced down to 12.5 years. And the reason it was reduced is because I was found to have a lack of involvement in that crime. Additionally, she would have told him, I'm a mother of four now. I've ran a successful business in the past. And maybe even more key, getting back to the defendants, she gave information that was false. When she applied for the job, she was told, we're only going to go back 7 years into your criminal history. Well, this took place in 1996. 2015 is when she applied. She had no idea they would see this. She thought she was truthfully filling out the form. She thought it only went back 7 years. She hasn't violated the law since she's got out. So that's the story she would have told him, Your Honor. She would have told him, you know, I was a young kid. If you look at it, I wasn't really involved in the crime. That's what the court said when it reduced my sentence. Since then, I've got out. I misunderstood the application. I went on what somebody told me. It was only going to go back 7 years. I have no issues at 7 years. So that's what she would have told him, Your Honor. Would that have changed the day? I don't know. But I think this court, in the case of Citizens Telecommunication v. FCC, probably made a statement that applies to why she has standing today. And this court there found where proper notice is not given and an opportunity to contest is lost, you have a concrete harm. And you have standing. And that's what we have here today. And further, the Third and the Seventh Circuits have both found where an employer fails to give, takes an adverse action and fails to give a copy of the consumer report and an opportunity to contest or to explain that information in the consumer report, you have concrete harm and you have standing. In fact, the Seventh Circuit went even farther, and they kind of said something similar to what Your Honor, I think, was hinting at. They said, if you can allow a person to give a contextual explanation, that may be almost as powerful as the accuracy of the consumer report. And to further, I've got a quote from the Seventh Circuit that I think goes to what Your Honor was getting at. There they said that Robinson has not pleaded what she may have said if given the chance to respond, or that she may not have convinced Allied to honor its employment offer is immaterial to the substance of her interest in responding. Article 3 strictures are not met only when a plaintiff complains of being deprived of a benefit. But they also are met when a plaintiff complains she was deprived of a chance to obtain the benefit.
Is that the Robertson case?
That is the Robertson case, Your Honor.
How do you address the Ninth Circuit's contrary decision in the Duda versus State Farm? And all of these cases were decided after briefing was completed in this
right.
case.
Right. And so the Duda case, Your Honor, one, we're on a motion to dismiss standard here. Duda was on a summary judgment standard. So we have completely different standards before the court. Both Robertson and the Long case in front of the Third Circuit were on the same standards that this court has in front of it today. They're a motion to dismiss standards. So that would be the first thing I would say. Two, I would say that there was an affidavit there that said we weren't going to hire her no matter what. But if you consider what that court held, because they weren't going to hire her no matter what, the fact that she lost the opportunity doesn't matter, that would conflict with what this court held in the Citizens Telecommunication case. Because this court here didn't say, well, you didn't give proper notice, but you know what? They were going to change the law anyway, so it doesn't matter. No, this court said, hey, you've got to give proper notice. You at least got to give the opportunity to be heard. And if you fail to do that, we have a concrete harm. And so that's what I'd ask this court once again to hold in this matter.
Do you agree that what's your position on the district court's view that standing at this point doesn't matter because of the conditional settlement? Do you agree that this court or the district court does have to look at whether there was standing for the plaintiff's claims?
I have the utmost respect for Judge Lowry. I don't think she got it right, Your Honor. At the end of the day, though, that's the reason I'm up here telling you why we have standing on a disclosure form that didn't tell her exactly what they were going to do, and the fact that she never authorized them to get a certain portion of her snapshot of her life. Okay, I think Judge Lowry was ruling right after Spokio came out. I think if we would go stand in front of Judge Lowry again and give these exact same arguments, we'd probably have a completely different outcome. Be honest, Your Honor. She was in a tough situation. We were right after Spokio, to be honest. So, Your Honors, I would ask you to take note of the fact that at the end of the day, we have employers who are handing a form, and the form requires them to have a clear and conspicuous disclosure that consists solely of the disclosure and at most the authorization to ensure that the consumer fully understands the power that they are handing that employer.
Let me ask you, do you agree with Ms. Brooks that we should go and in the first instance decide the standing issue, since the district court didn't?
I think that the standing issue has to be decided, yes, Your Honor.
Should we do it in the first instance, or should the district court?
Your Honor, I think it can be done here. I think if Judge Lowry has the opportunity, plaintiff really doesn't have a preference. I think standing's evident no matter if we're in this court or in the district court. If we go back down there and Judge Lowry does what I expect her to do with the case law that is currently out there, and standing is found, I imagine we will be right here again. But I would tell you that this court has enough precedent out there between Hagelin and the Citizens Telecommunication case that standing is evident by this court's precedent as well. Your Honor, at the end of the day, I'd ask this court to find standing is evident, to find concrete harm has happened, and allow this matter to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins.
I'd like to address just a few points that Jason made and answer any additional questions. In the joint appendix is the authorization form. And he cited one part about the authorization form, but not the key part. The authorization form at page 98 of the joint appendix said, "We have the intent to utilize a third party to conduct criminal background search." In another part of the form, she said, "I authorize the company and its representatives to make an independent investigation of my criminal record." So even though Mr. Driscoll asserts there's too much information in the form, she consented. It's clear in black and white. And then that is exactly what the company did. It went and got a criminal background report. And it used solely for the purposes that it said. Now, there was some questions by Judge Graz about whether or not what she would have said.
Well, I maybe I'm confused. I thought it was pled that the company obtained much more information than just a criminal background check.
The criminal background check is in the record, and the only substantive information that's in the report is a criminal background check.
Are we limited to the pleadings here? Was this a 12B1 situation?
No, it is not.
It was a summary judgment?
Yes, it was. It was factually attacked, but I don't believe it was pled. There was no pleading on it.
I guess it wasn't decided, so we really don't know what it. The district court didn't decide the standing question, so we don't know whether it's a 12B1 or a summary judgment, or how should we look at it?
I respectfully think it should be decided as under a summary judgment standard. Both parties had the opportunity in submitted additional evidence outside of the pleadings as to what exactly was requested and what exactly was provided, and when the decision was made and why the decision. That was fully presented in the record. But so on my point about what she would have said in response, she signed her consent form that's in the joint appendix. She wrote in her own handwriting that in response to a question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? She wrote, no. I was once arrested in 1996 at age 17 and then found not guilty. That was the driver for the decision, because that's a false statement. Now, because she was, in fact, found guilty. So, and the one last point I'd like to raise is in the joint appendix at page JA-112 is the notice that the company sent to Rhea Schumacher after it had obtained the report. And it clearly states, if your intent to dispute the criminal background report, it is required you inform us within 7 days from your receipt of this letter. She doesn't respond at all. And, of course, we know why. It's because there's nothing she can say that she was, in fact, convicted of the crime. Mr. Driscoll mentioned the Hagelin case, which in his brief he describes as a violation of control of information regarding her person. And in that Hagelin case, driver's record information, which was confidential, was obtained and then used, so it was both private information and obtained without her consent. And so the Hagelin decision was decided based upon those two points, which is it becomes a privacy issue because you never told them you were gathering this information and you did so without their consent. Here we have both. We have, do you consent to us obtaining a criminal background check? In reality, she consents by the documents in the record. There's nothing in the pleading that refutes that. And the information that obtained is not private. It's criminal background history, which, frankly, could be found on the internet, through the court system, or through a consumer reporting agency. Are there no other questions? Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Counsel, we appreciate your arguments today. The case is submitted and will be decided in due course.